You are listening to KOWSLP Occidental 92.5 FM, serving Santa Rosa and West Sonoma County for 18 years, streaming to the world at kowsfm.com from our studios in Santa Rosa, California. You can visit our website to listen, donate, or volunteer. Our email address is kows@sonic.net. You can also download the Radio Rethink streaming app from the App Store.
Cal's Radio thanks Cloverdale Connect for their support. Cloverdale Connect delivers their free paper every month to homes, businesses, and post office boxes in the greater Cloverdale area. They are also available online at cloverdaleconnect.com.
Cal's is underwritten in part by Many Rivers Books and Tea. Many Rivers specializes in tools for spiritual practice, tea, and teaware. They are located at 130 South Main Street, Suite 101 in Sebastopol, and can be found online at manyriversbooks.com. They can also be reached by phone at area code 707-829-8871.
Hello and welcome back on this lovely spring day in West Sonoma County. You are listening to The Mountain, an adoration in a multitude of parts, and I'm your host, Andrew Lewis. For those of you who are just joining us, this is a serialized story being spun out over many weeks. It's about a young artist in San Diego in the early 1990s, about an installation that he did in a Catholic church, about a long walk, and about just about anything else under the sun, which is, I guess, an attempt to test the proposition that anything can make a good story if told in the right way. Which brings me to my latest thought. I have a friend who was going to write me an email, and apparently before she could get to it, the intelligence stepped in, I guess the Google intelligence, and without her knowing, combed through all of her emails and then attempted to respond to something I'd written. Which is really, really crazy, because fortunately she stopped it before it could do any more dirty work. But I imagine there are a lot of people out there who might just think, who cares? And you just hit send and let the intelligence respond for you. Well, the problem is, there are a lot of problems. One is that eventually the intelligence will, all the intelligence will just start responding to one another. And they'll be talking to one another and we won't even be part of it. And worse yet, if you think about it, it's actually just one big intelligence. And so it's going to be kind of psychotically just chattering to itself. But there's something far worse, and that is that each of us have lived these full and varied and wonderful, beautiful lives. And the lives that we've lived have shaped our voices and made us the unique and inimitable persons that we are. And it allows us to speak in our own particular voice and with our own nuances in whatever ungainly or beautiful way that may present itself. And if we give up that most vital part of ourselves to the intelligence, we literally say, I don't want to live my life anymore, and I'd prefer for you to live and speak and respond for me. There's a great tragedy in that. And it just goes to prove something else, that there are strange and magical and fantastical things occurring to us all about us in this very moment. In recent weeks, some of you may know that I've taken to telling some of the stories from the Arabian Nights, which itself was the original gangster story, the original Shaggy Dog story. And, you know, you can look at it in one way and say it's just a bunch of folk tales or children tales with genies and magic and magicians and all of that. But it also bears in mind that we have such fantastical things in our lives today that I don't think there's any real difference between a genie and Claude. Wow. Claude. Talk about a diminishment. Anyway, regarding the Arabian Nights, for those of you who are just joining us, we're in the middle of a bit of a tangle of stories about a merchant who had inadvertently taken the life of the son of a genie, and for this reason he was going to give up his own life, and the genie was going to strike him dead. And while he was waiting for his fate, three old men happened to cross upon him sitting there in the desert, and one of them had led a doe on a chain, and the other one was accompanied by two black dogs, and there was a third old man. And they heard the merchant's tale, and the old man with the doe had asked the genie, he had said, if I can tell you a story that is more strange and more fantastical than the story of you and your now dead son, will you grant me a third of the merchant's life? And the genie had said, yes. And so he began to tell a tale of how he had taken his cousin for his wife, and she could not give him children. And then for this reason, he had taken upon him a mistress, and she bore him a son. And then some years later, he had gone away on travel. And while he was away, his first wife, in a fit of jealousy, had used magical means to transform his mistress and his son into a cow and a calf. And then when he had returned home, he inadvertently took the life of his mistress and slit her throat. And he was about to do the same with his own son. And he continued to tell his tale to the genie. I took the knife, he said. I took the knife and I bound the calf. And as I bent to kill this creature, it wept and it rolled at my feet, its tongue lolling out of its mouth. And my heart, it trembled with such sadness at such a curious thing, this poor thing not wanting to die, just looking at me. And I said to my wife, I said, I shall set him free and leave him in your care. And then I promised my wife that I would slaughter another calf, and then I promised that I would kill this one in a year's time. And then the next day, as the morning broke, my shepherd, he came to me, and he said, I have for you some good news, he said. Will you reward me? And I said to him, I shall, of course, I shall. And he explained, I have a daughter, and she has studied magic and the dark arts. And yesterday, when I brought the calf you spared, my daughter, she looked at it, and she laughed, and she said, why, this calf, he's the son of our master, the merchant. Can't you see? A spell was put on him, transforming him into a calf. And in the same way, she transformed this poor calf's mother, or the boy's mother, the mistress, into a cow, and that he, in fact, slaughtered her. What great tragedy this is. And so when I heard this, or when the shepherd heard this from his daughter, he came to me as quickly as he could, and he told me. And then when I heard this, I was so overtaken, I fainted to the ground. And when I awoke, I followed the shepherd to his house. I threw myself at my son, who was a calf, and I held the calf in my arms, and he pressed his face to mine, and my cheeks were damp with my own tears, and his tongue was jutting from his mouth as if to say, pity me, please, please have pity on me and all that has become me. And so I turned to the shepherd's daughter and I said, if you release him, If you can break this spell, then I will give you everything that I have. I will give you all of my cows and all of my fortune. And the shepherd's daughter, she smiled and said, I have no desire for your wealth and for your cattle. But I will set this animal free on two conditions. That you let me marry him. And that you allow me to cast a spell on your wife, that enchantress, so that we shall be safe from her harm. And I said, do whatever you want. I said, my property, everything that I own, my son, it all is yours. And as for my wife who did this and made me kill my mistress, her blood is yours to take. She looked at me, she said, no, but I will let her taste what she has done to others. And so the shepherd's daughter, she filled a clay bowl with water, and she spoke her words and uttered her spell. And she said to my son, if God has made you a calf, then stay as you are, but if you have been enchanted and been transformed into this creature, then return to your native form. And the animal shook, this calf, he shook, and he changed back into a man, and my eyes cast upon him, and I saw my son, and I told him what had happened to his mother, how I had slit her throat. And I said, God has sent us someone, however, to avenge you. And then I gave my son in marriage to the shepherd's daughter. And she went to my wife, and she then in turn transformed her into this deer. And then she said, why, look at this pretty beast. If you allow her to live with us and keep us company, better that she does that than that she bring misfortune into this world. And so this deer who I have with me now, she stayed with us for days and nights and months and years. And then one day the shepherd's daughter died, and my son in grief left and traveled abroad to this country, to the land of this merchant whose life you are about to take. And I followed, I went after him to find out if I could discover what had become of my son. And I brought with me this deer. And that is my story. And is it not the strangest that you have ever heard? And the genie, he looked at the man with the deer and he said, I shall grant you a third of the merchant's blood. And then the second old man, the one with two black dogs, he said to the genie, he said, if I tell you my story, the one with these dogs, and you find it stranger than anything you have heard, will you grant me a third of the merchant's blood? And the genie said, I shall. And so the old man stepped forward and he said, but it was at that moment that the sun overtook the night and gained on Shahrazad and cut her speaking short. What a strange story, her sister Dunyazad said. And Shahrazad looked to her and looked to the king Shahryar and said, if I am allowed to live another night, I can tell you far, far stranger. And so the king, the great sultan, spared Shahrazad's life for another day. Thank you.
escape from this desert sea. Lord, I think that the devil might be after me. I don't wanna waste my integrity. I'm just a man living a one night stand. I'll tell you what I need. Oh, Black Creek, take me to that place and wash my sins away. Oh, Black Creek, take me to that place and wash my sins away. Just a little taste, that's all I need. Fruitful harvest and a wicked garden of a forbidden tree. A simple scheme for judging fate. Simple as it may be, it's more than I can take. Oh, Black Creek, take me to that place. Wow. Wash my sins away. Oh, Black Creek, take me to that place. Wash my sins away. Like a glass of tea mixed with a zest of fresh fruit and a breath of high ground. Oh, Black Creek, take me to that place. Wash my sin away. Oh, Black Creek, take me to that place. Wash my sin. Won't you wash my sin away?
John the Baptist had cloaked himself in a camel hair garment bound with a leather cord, and he preached repentance in the wilderness of Judea, and he baptized the penitents in the River Jordan. It was said that a man from Nazareth would come to him to be baptized unto the Lord. And John, he refused, and then he conceded. He proclaimed the man the Son of God, and the heavens opened, and the Spirit of God descended and lit upon him as a dove, and the voice of God was heard, and his Holy Spirit was made present. The men who would one day become the disciples, Andrew and John the Beloved, were supposedly present in that moment, and they bore witness. A print studio in Long Beach, California. Hours before dawn, John Brockley mounts a large sheet of white Stonehenge paper and marks out the dimensions of the mat board in pencil. He thins out oil-based paint with paint thinner and applies a white wash. He lets it dry. He thins out an oxidized blue and applies this wash on the upper half. Onto this paper, John would print the image of the baptism. Christ's back is turned. John scratches in the lines of chiseled shoulders and the ligature of muscles that seem to bind their bodies. The Baptist is gaunt, his hair and slight beard unkempt. His arms extend out, Goya-like, the hands suspended, palms upward above the head of the Christ. A dove takes flight from his outstretched hands. There are no beams of light. Both he and Jesus are naked, save for cloth bound about their loins. Later, on the frame that would encase the panel, John would lay down the 8-inch strips of dotted lines on paper so fragile that when wet they would sometimes disintegrate. The paper would lay crooked. John would remove the paper, discard it, and apply another. When finished, the retabla would be mounted within an arched pattern, the dotted lines marking out what had previously been destined to become the panel of a shirt or a jacket or a dress. But now those dashes delineated something else, something larger, inviting us to wonder the nature of the pattern, of what garment to which it was a part. Welcome back to the mountain, an adoration in a multitude of parts. And I'm your host, Andrew Lewis. And it's time for the usual warning. We're going to take a bit of a detour. Today's story may have begun in an art studio, but by the time we're done, many worlds we will have known since then. For over 2,000 years, the profession of faith has writ names not just upon the land, but upon us. And through our names, parts of the story become instantiated in our flesh to be lived again and again. consider that there had once been a canyon in Southern California that had opened up to a river valley where had stood a concrete bricked bathroom where gay men would cruise for sex. And that this bathroom stood a dozen yards from a freeway that had been laid down over an ancient riverbed that in times past had been the home of a native people. Already those images pushed the bounds of credibility. Now place a neighborhood above the canyon, a neighborhood of craftsmen and Spanish-style homes, a neighborhood called Mission Hills, and declare that no small number who lived there would spend their time at work or in the bedrooms of others, inside their blinds closed, oblivious to the unfolding tragedies of their own children. And then place a small boy, 8 years old or 9 at best, jacked on cornflakes soaked in turned milk in front of a television, fighting with his brother over which Saturday morning cartoons to watch. And then consider that afternoon when I led my brother in his pajamas up the hill from the park where once had stood the old Fort Stockton. And imagine my younger self claiming to see cops and instructing my brother to hide in bushes, and us slowly secreting our way up the winding Presidio Drive, paved in white cement, a green line running down the middle. The street was lined with Spanish-style mansions built in the 1920s. Red-tiled roofs, thick white stucco walls, homes that sported views of the San Diego Bay. The houses on the other side of the street were mid-century modern, picture Brady Bunch. They'd been built on plots that were less desirable because the ground was so heavily sloped. These streets were wealthy and fantastic. That's what you might see today. But that doesn't tell you anything. There's no real understanding. To understand one particular aspect of that hillside, you have to go deeper, to a time before the mid-century modern, before the Spanish manses, before the concrete road had been laid, before there was a neighborhood, before there was a before, before the before. You have to go back to a 15-year-old Shoshone girl, and to the slaved man, and to the dog, and to the dead corpses littering the villages that had once lined the River Columbia, and to the baby on the back.
Thank you.
The name of the baby's father was Toussaint, All Saint. He came from the town of Boucherville in Quebec, where he'd been born near about 1760. We may not know the exact year of his birth, but we can hazard the day, November 1st, All Saints' Day. He came from a family of explorers. He himself was Métis and perhaps ran in him Iroquois blood. In his 30s, he'd made his way west to the Manitoba, where he trapped beaver for the Northwest Company. At the age of 35, he was stabbed by an Ojibwe woman with an awl because he had raped her young daughter. And 5 years later, in the year 1801, he found himself in exile in the wildlands of the Western Territory. He had followed the beaver near to the headwaters of the Little Missouri in the open country of the Hidatsa. There, on what was probably a drunken night, he was gambling, throwing what form of dice we'll never know, polished plum stones tossed into a curved bowl set on the packed earth, let's say. And this man of failing teeth took as his prize two girls not more than the age of 12. They'd been captured in a war raid 2 years earlier on the Missouri in the homeland of the northern band of the Shoshone. Toussaint won them as his own, and he took them as his slave brides. No doubt that first night, or if not then, surely soon after, he raped them, as one does. A lone trapper walking the rivers and forests in the wilds of North America in 1801 does not take as a prize two children save to cook and clean for him and to consort with him in the cold nights. And then he quit that country. In the spring, he traveled eastward with his child brides in tow, periodically trapping the beaver. He would sell the skins at trading posts on the river. From there, the pelts were floated downriver to San Luis. And then they'd make their way to New York, there to be fashioned into hats and coats and industries established by a certain John Jacob Astor, who in turn would ship them to Europe. As well, Toussaint's raw pelts may have been shipped to Canton to be traded for tea and opium. Enriched by the China trade of the pelts of hundreds of ne'er-do-well trappers, Astor would build one of the greatest fortunes ever known, equivalent in his day to the $200 billion amassed by Jeff Bezos. He bought up much of Manhattan. His name was branded on the country. Astoria, Oregon, Astor Place, the Waldorf Astoria, Astoria, Queens. It's not for us to know in our lifetimes all the ways in which our small lives intersect with the currents of history, with the eddies and turns in the water that might maroon us on the bank or carry us deep and far over some glissading falls.
Thank you. steps of your back door. It's one of those days where the only thing that moves is the laundry on the line and a dusty dog that bites just to kill the time.
In the autumn of 1804, the impoverished trapper and the two girls were overwintering in a wigwam with the Mandan in Dakota lands. One of the girls, possibly at the age of 14, now carried his child. That autumn, men arrived. They had set out that summer from San Luis, the capital far to the south. It was a military outfit under the orders of the great President Jefferson. The year prior, all the lands west of the Mississippi had been purchased from Napoleon. The great emperor had given up land which he could hardly defend in exchange for money to fill his coffers so he could mount his assaults on Naples and Sicily and Egypt. The task of these men was to follow the rivers upcountry to the Pacific Ocean. They were to map and document all that they would see. They were to compile lexicons of the native languages and make peace with these people. They were to draw and catalog the flora and the fauna, and to document the fantastical beasts that were said to roam this land, the mastodon and the clawed megalonyx. They were to draw maps so that the territory could be populated and owned. This crew of men, originally numbering more than 45, arrived in the Mandan camp. They had among them military officers, trappers, mixed-breed men familiar with some of the languages. A large man with black skin, the slave and body man of one Captain Clark. He could swim and was a skilled hunter. Winter was setting in, and they put to building structures. For the trapper Toussaint, his destiny to him was clear. When the contingent arrived in the Mandan village, he would have observed that these strangers were well kitted, not without resources. It would be to his fortune to sign up with them. And so he requested an audience. He knew the territory, he told them. He knew the languages, he knew the people. He could speak Hidatsa and French. He could be an interlocutor. He could be their guide. He was, of course, encumbered with the girl who was uniformly referred to as his squaw, or the native woman. And the captains of this expedition, no doubt, would have, at some point, they would have had to have asked to see her to assess her measure. She was young and with child. She spoke the Shoshone, Toussaint said. The two captains, they were unsure of the Frenchman. But they saw the value that the girl could have as an interpreter. And one of their party could speak French to Toussaint, who could then speak with her in Mandan and Hidatsa. She was hardly more than a sylph of a child. On the swelling knoll of her belly, her placed hand. After some deliberation, they conceded and said that he could come. He would be given $500.33 and a horse in compensation. But you see, in that first audience, in whatever form it took, that girl would undoubtedly have been making her own assessment. And she would have received these things: that these were great men, that they were at the service of a great chief, that they knew the markings in books, that they had instruments by which they could measure the movement of the sun and the stars, that they commanded men that would do their bidding, and that the men towed with them a great canoe. She would have known, if only with the faint awareness of a child, that her fate, her future, the test of her measure, would rest with these men and the journey on which they had embarked, and that with them she could be carried home to her people. 2 months later, the girl gave birth. Her labor was difficult. Meriwether Lewis was called to assist. He administered a tincture of rattlesnake venom, which he had learned from the physician Rush, or even from his own mother, a noted herbalist and healer in the Piedmont of Virginia. And that is how a baby boy came into this world on a cold night in the winter of 1805 in the land we now know as North Dakota. He was born about a quarter mile up bank from the Missouri. His last name would be that of his father, Charbonneau, and he would be given the French Catholic name of Jean-Baptiste. His father was, by nearly all accounts, a rake with no saving attribute save a penchant for self-preservation and confabulation. His mother, only recently not a child, would be remembered for the rest of American time. Her Shoshone name, Tsokuisowip, mud thrower. It was a child's name, Tsokuisowip. But the Hidatsa had no such word. They pronounced it as best they could. Bird woman, Tsakagawias, became her slave name. This girl, without a mother, would suckle the baby. She no doubt would have been under the care and instruction of the Mandan women and sisters who would have seen and understood the plight of this young woman. It was the plight of them all. And as a tribe of mothers, it was their obligation to care for her.
Thank you.
You have been listening to The Mountain, An Adoration in a Multitude of Parts, and this is your host, Andrew Lewis. Thank you for joining us on this long journey, this journey that you might begin to feel is without end. But worry not, all good stories do come to an end. I also would like to thank Chris Lothar and Drusilla Gould of the Shoshone Language Project out of the University of Utah, who were able to provide the true and accurate pronunciation of Sacagawea's name. Any mispronunciations are, of course, my own, and I hope I'll be forgiven. For her great service and ultimately great sacrifice to our nation, Tsawagwisui deserves her name. If you'd like to know more about the Core of Discovery, you can go straight to the source, Moulton's compiled collection of all the journals, fully transcribed, are available digitally and are fully searchable. The composite words and observations captured by these unpresuming and barely literate men, and especially the unequaled journals of Meriwether Lewis, stand as one of the great American treasures. We open today with Black Creek by Brent Cobb, followed by Miles to Go by Eileen Jewell. Other songs include that lovely rendition of En Canadien Errant, sung by John and Mary, two of the surviving members of the 10,000 Maniacs after their breakup. I had the great pleasure of being introduced to them at the Chabalaba Coffee House in Barrio Logan in 1992. You also heard One of Those Days, another delightful song by Eileen Jewell. We also heard a particularly compelling version of Neil Young's Helpless, sung by Katie Lang. We'll walk you out with Oh My Girl by Jesse Sykes and The Sweet Hereafter. If you're enjoying these stories, I encourage you to subscribe to The Mountain Substack. Just Google or do a search for The Mountain, An Adoration in a Multitude of Parts, and the Substack should come up. As well as hopefully a link to the Spotify podcast version of this Shaggy Dog story. If you subscribe to the Substack, you will get updates. It allows me to communicate with you and give you updates on all things Mountain. And you should also have access to additional material that isn't available here on the radio version, including, by the way, images of the work that was completed in the church in San Diego so many years ago. And by all means, If you enjoy the listen, and it makes your world a little bigger, I would be grateful and indebted if you would share with your friends. Please have a great day or a good night wherever you are.
Across that sunlit room. Oh my.